Okay, welcome to Mythology Part 4. Today we're going to talk about Greek heroes. And also what heroes mean in general. There are quite a few heroes in hero stories, so we will talk about the meaning of heroes in general, and Perseus, who got the head of Medusa, and Hercules, or Heracles in Greek, and Theseus, who slew the Minotaur. Okay, so let's say first, what are heroes? What is a hero? Well, we saw before in the ancient Near East, one of the first hero stories, maybe the first one, the Epic of Gilgamesh. And this kind of sets the tone. Some of the Greek stories, it turns out, actually copied that and knew that and maybe made use of that in borrowings from that into Greek literature. Well, heroes come in this chronological progression of mythology, from creation of the world to the births of the gods to the creation of people and heroes or demigods. The heroes are between gods and mortals. And all myth seems to have something to do with religion. We've seen that all along, that sometimes we're talking about religion. Sometimes myth means somebody else's religion. There used to be a religion, but you don't believe it anymore. So people say, did they believe this stuff? Yeah, they believed it. Why did it die out? Because their culture died out. Religion goes with the culture. So another reason is full of all kinds of general themes about the humanities themselves. Okay, but here's the point I was saying. Myth is bound up with religion, and so these heroes are from an early time when people are close to the gods. There's a term called the first time, that religion and mythology deal with the first time, the beginning of time. So for the Greeks, this would be their early history. We're not going to get into whether Heracles lived or not, but this is what they told about their early history. And these would be set in what we call the Bronze Age. In other words, we know more about the history than they did, and the Bronze Age was a time of palaces in Greece, like Mycenae. And this would be, especially around 1400 to 1200 BC, was when Mycenae was at its height. Mycenaean is a term for the civilization around mainland Greece at that time, the late Bronze Age, or especially at its height, 1400 to 1200 BC. There were palaces all around Greece. Archaeologists found these palaces, and this is where the hero stories are set. The heroes were supposed to be people from this early time who were usually kings of these palaces. So the stories would be set then. That would be the dramatic date. But we don't have literature from that time. The Greek literature is centuries and centuries later. If Homer is writing in the 8th century BC, remember that's when they got the alphabet, that's when they could write down these traditional stories that went back further back to the Bronze Age. And from the 8th century and then tragedies in the 5th century and so on, these were all stories about this earlier period, 1200 BC and earlier, when the heroes would have lived. The stories are set then. So for them, that's like the beginning of time when people were still close to the gods and talked to the gods and were children of gods. Okay, so that is something existential about heroes. And that's kind of my take, that heroes show something about humanity. Heroes are often a demigod. They'll have a god for a parent, but they're not gods. They'll have one mortal parent. So they're half and half, a demigod. And which way are they going to go? Are they going to be like a god and do great things and try to be immortal? But they have one parent who's immortal. Does that bring them down? Are they going to die? So they're in this in-between stage between gods and mortals. And that's what the stories say a lot about us. They say a lot about human beings. It's not just what Hercules did at this time. It's not just whether Hercules did something in 1275 BC or 1300 BC or whenever he was. It's not facts about history. It's what these stories show about humanity in the world. Now, you can take that many ways. Like we said, you can think about myth many ways. Heroes go on quests. Heroes kill beasts. Why do heroes go on quests? Well, much of literature is about this, the journey, the quest. What are people questing for? Some knowledge of life, right? Heroes go to the limits. They want to go to the edge of the world or to the underworld, to push the limit to see how far they can go, to see how far humanity can go, right? You know this saying, when they climbed Mount Everest. They said, why did you climb Mount Everest? Because it was there, right? We want to know. And so there's many theories about what's the meaning of this journey. You know, is it a biological urge we have in us? Carl Jung, the psychologist, talks about a spiritual quest that they search for ultimate meaning. And this is what Joseph Campbell picked up in these popular TV shows and books he wrote, which, by the way, morphed into New Age spiritualism. And there are many different theories like that. So, as I said, I take kind of an existential view that this shows about humanity. Okay, but let's see how it goes. First, we can say a hero pattern. There are a variety of heroes and hero stories. And there are some patterns in their lives. There are some common features of things heroes do, like a couple we mentioned. And so, somebody actually wrote a book and said there are like these 35 things. And for every hero, you can check off the 35 or, you know, 25 for each one. And so this would be an outline of the life of a hero. Special features. The hero pattern. And the interesting book about that is called In Quest of the Hero. Okay? One is the birth. There's a special birth. A hero often has a miraculous birth. One parent might be a god. And so usually a demigod, which raises the question, is the hero a god or a human? Then the hero grows up, and typically the hero is supposed to be a king, like the son of a king. But often the hero is expelled from the kingdom, and that would be the second stage, one element in the pattern. Often the hero is expelled from the kingdom, and has to... After that, number three, has to grow up to manhood and prove himself. And it usually is manhood because there are very few hero stories about women. There are a couple, interestingly enough. So three would be grow to manhood. How? By doing great deeds or going on a quest. Often the hero has divine help or divine favor. In Greek, you actually see Athena often with a hero. We'll see this in some of the slides. That's a way of saying the hero has a divine nature and does special feats. And so these deeds are special. The journey may be to the edge of the earth where no one else can go. You know, Star Trek, where no man has gone before, that kind of thing. Or it may be going to do something that would kill anybody else but you survive. So overcoming death. Or sometimes even go to Hades and come back to overcome death. That they are special and have a some kind of godlike quality. Or their deeds may promote civilization. Heroes will do things like defeat beasts. And you can see this as order triumphing over chaos, just like Zeus did in the universe. To start the universe, Zeus had to defeat all these monsters and establish order, which in Greek is cosmos, which means the ordered universe. Well, heroes will do that on Earth. So they're an early stage of the Earth where they are the good guys defeating the bad guys, or cosmos over chaos. They make the world safe for civilization the way Zeus did that in heaven, right? So that's another way you go from gods to heroes to people. So after these various deeds, which of course will be different for each hero, the hero might win a woman and marry someone. The next stage would be to win a kingdom. So the hero might sometimes marry a princess and inherit the kingdom from her father. Interestingly enough, that means a son-in-law would succeed in that case. Or the hero might prove to be so great at this point that they may go back and take the kingdom they were expelled from and get the natural birthright back. And, of course, being a king and ruling is not the interesting thing about a hero. That's just everyday politics. So you don't hear as much at that point. It's all how they prove themselves to be great. And then the question of their death. That would be the last stage. What happens? Do they have a special death? In Greek, mortals are mortals. Even heroes are mortals. So it's a fascinating thing in Greek called the mortal hero. They learn about their mortality. Isn't that what Gilgamesh learned? But occasionally a hero can receive a gift of immortality from the gods. And this would be a special gift. A god can pluck you up and take you off someplace. In other words, you don't expect to earn it. They don't think, oh, if I'm really good, I can live on. They don't think it's inside everybody. They don't earn it through virtue the way Christianity teaches us. So it was rare, but it can happen. So that's something else to look for. Do they get that? What do they want to get as the ultimate goal? Or do they get knowledge and wisdom about life as Gilgamesh did? So that's all a little bit abstract, but that will come up in all the stories we'll see, okay? And somebody actually wrote a book saying that this pattern fits the life of Jesus. That Jesus is like a Greek hero story. What language are the lives of Jesus written in? Ancient Greek, right? That he has a special birth, one parent is a god, and everything else, right? Okay, so let's talk about one of the earliest Greek heroes. Let's start with him. And this is Perseus. Here's the spelling of his name, Perseus. This is the family from the region of Argos. There were dynasties around Greece, so hero stories are also local. There are various local dynasties. Argos is this area that also includes Mycenae and Tiryns, where we found the two large palaces from Bronze Age Greece. Two of the most famous ones are here, Mycenae and Tiryns. And this is the family of this area. Stories about the Bronze Age, the region of Argos. Okay. Well, there was a king named Acrisius. And he had a lovely daughter, Danae. So he wanted a grandson. And he went to the oracle, which would be probably the oracle of Apollo at Delphi, and asked, how can I get a grandson? Will I have a grandson? And the oracle replied, you will have a grandson, but he will kill you. Good news and bad news. That's typically Greek. You can never have both, by the way. You always have both. You never have one or the other. The Greeks thought if you were really lucky, well, this was bad luck because something bad was bound to happen because it had to tip the other way eventually. Zeus had two jars. They mixed the good and the evil for everybody. So that's typical. And it's also fate, right? If the oracle says this, that is a god speaking. This is fate. So Acrisius tries to avoid his fate. He locks up his daughter in a chamber, in a bronze chamber. He obviously had not studied mythology, or he would know that you cannot escape fate in a Greek story. Right? Well, here's a picture of Danae by Klimt, this Austrian artist from the early 20th century. And who found a way to come to Danae? Zeus came as a shower of gold. Here he is, manages to make it look erotic, and Zeus impregnated Danae, who has a son, Perseus, our hero. Well, the grandfather wants to get rid of him, so he builds a chest and puts the mother and the baby in this chest and sends them out to sea. He wants to get rid of them. It's the second time he wants to avoid his fate. And they sail across the Aegean Sea. And they come to a lovely island, Seriphos. But the Greek islands had not become idyllic tourist destinations yet. And they didn't want to be there. So they wash up, and a fisherman takes them in, who's the good guy, and he wants to marry Danae. His name is Dictys, that's not so important. But he has an evil brother named Polydectes. And Polydectes wants to seize Danae for himself, so he has to get rid of Perseus. And he says to Perseus, who's growing up to manhood now, he says, go get me the head of the Gorgon. Okay, who were the Gorgons? Well, this is something that's meant to send Perseus to his death. So this is the deed he has to achieve and overcome to prove he's a hero. that the Gorgons live beyond the edge of the world. They are a type of deity. They are actually these monsters from the early days of creation that we're calling chaos generally. There are three Gorgons and the three sisters. The most famous one is Medusa. So here's Medusa. The Gorgon is the type, and Medusa is one of the three sisters. She's always looking like this right at you because, of course, her gaze turns you to stone. And she's got these snakes for hair and fangs and this exaggerated grimace. Okay, and she's the only one who's mortal. She has actually tusks also and wings. Usually you just see her head like these slides. Let's see another one. And she's always shown frontally like this, but her head is always frontal, but her body can be sideways like this with wings. Let's see another one. Here's another Medusa from an archaic period temple. And here's three more Medusas from modern art. That's a lamp called the Medusa lamp. Okay. So Perseus has to go get the head of Medusa. Well, Athena helps him. He has divine help. Remember, he's the son of Zeus. And Athena helps him because he has divine favor, and that's saying he has a special nature himself. So she tells him what to do. First, he has to visit these three old women called the Graiai. This means gray old women, like three hags. They live out in the they live near Atlas. Where is Atlas? He's in the far west. He's near the Straits of Gibraltar, where it's still called the Atlas Mountains today in Morocco there. And so that's saying you're going past our world, which say it's a disk of Earth, and all around it is water called ocean. So he has to go to Atlas, and then past that is ocean, and beyond that are all kinds of monsters and lands where people usually don't go, lands of the gods, both good and bad. People like the Gorgons are out there. So when he goes to see the Graiai, that's there, and that's saying he's gone beyond our world. These three old women, they share one tooth and one eye between them. So Perseus grabs the eye and demands that they tell him what to do, and they tell him, go see these nymphs. So obviously now he's going further west off the map into divine territory, and the nymphs help him. They give him a cap that makes him invisible, which is Hades' cap, because the name Hades might mean invisible. In Greek, it didn't always have the H, so the A might mean not seen. Anyway, it was Hades' cap of invisibility. Doesn't something like this come up in Harry Potter, book one, right? Which is all mythology. This just shows how much we want mythology. And they give him winged sandals, because he has to fly far away. And they give him a special sword made out of adamantine. And they give him a leather pouch, because he is supposed to behead Medusa. And if he does this, he has to put her head in a pouch. That's like going through the x-ray and putting your film in a pouch. So the head doesn't stun him, because it still has power after she's beheaded. So, and then he has a shield. And this is actually unusual to have magic like this. Greek mythology usually does not have magic and tricks or smoke and mirrors, so-called, like this. Maybe this is because it's earlier. He's an earlier hero, and also these are folktale elements that come into the story, many more generic elements like magic that you see around the world. So he flies off, Perseus flies off, past ocean, flying out to the west, to where the Gorgons live. And how does he behead Medusa? Well, he can't go right up to her, so he uses his shield as a mirror, and goes up to her sideways, and beheads her. I guess she wasn't that swift flying away here. And here's art of Perseus looking sideways and beheading Medusa with his special sword. And here's another one Okay, who is that on the far left? Athena. In art, they often show Athena with a hero. Now, the stories don't say that Athena was there, and Perseus does it by himself. But Athena is looking over him. That's a way of saying he's a hero. He has divine favor and some divine nature himself. So Perseus beheads Medusa. Well, what flies out of her neck? Okay. Pegasus, the winged horse, flies out. That was her son. And that was the son of Medusa. It was born out of her neck at this point. Well, along with some other character, Chrysaor, who's not well known. And this is the mobile oil logo. It gives you horsepower, right? And actually, why did a winged horse come out of her neck? Well, there are some stories that Medusa was half mare. In fact, in this slide, you can see that she's half horse. And there was a story that Poseidon turned into a horse and mated with Medusa, who was in the form of a mare, and they gave birth to Pegasus. But weirdly, something happened, and Pegasus didn't come out until now. So who knows what happened there? But that makes sense about Poseidon, because Poseidon was associated with horses and horse stampedes and earthquakes like that. So that's something much older, where some deities were associated with animals. So Perseus flies away, maybe on Pegasus. He puts Medusa's head in this special sack and flies away. Some of the blood from Medusa drops into the desert when he's flying over the Sahara Desert. And scorpions come out of this. Poisonous reptiles, some kind of poisonous reptiles. So Perseus flies off. And notice he has overcome an experience that was supposed to lead to his death. So he's proving himself as a hero and going on to greater things. He's shown that he is somewhat godlike. On his way back to the island, he has another adventure. He's flying over, and he sees a damsel in distress, Andromeda. Andromeda is being chained to a rock in the sea, and a sea monster is coming up to devour her. A monster named Ceto, C-E-T-O. Perseus flies over and he thinks she's beautiful. So he's going to rescue Andromeda. Let's say what happened to Andromeda. How did she get in this condition? Well, her mother was Cassiopeia. Okay, this is in a place called Joppa, which seems to be in Syria, the coast of Syria. Her father was the king, and her mother, the queen, offended the gods by boasting that she was more beautiful than the sea nymphs, the Nereids. And these sea nymphs complained to Poseidon, and Poseidon sent this sea monster, Ceto. They had to sacrifice the king's daughter to appease this monster. And that's a choice sacrifice. You can think of other sacrifices of royal blood being the best type of blood to offer. So Ceto is the monster. We actually have a word in English. Cetacean means things relating to whales. It comes from this word. And we also know about sea monsters. There are things in the Bible like Leviathan or the whale that swallows Jonah. And this sea monster represents these monsters from the earlier stages of creation. Do you remember, oh, there were all these monsters and Zeus had to battle them to achieve order in the cosmos. But you cannot kill them completely. Sometimes they come back. The Loch Ness Monster would be like this. All these stories of the Loch Ness Monster. I used to watch shows on TV. Okay, here's some grainy photograph. You can see an outline of this, right? People are dying for these to be true. And it has a lot to do with religion, actually, because we want to know if Noah's Ark is true and so forth. We want to believe ancient things like that. And Now I think that's all myth, because the Loch Ness Monster is this common, very common pattern of these chaotic forces from the primal seas. And what happens? A hero has to defeat it to keep order on Earth. So Perseus, if he can do this, he'll be a hero doing this, like what Zeus did in the cosmos. And that, you can say, relates to heroes defeating bulls and wild boars and all kinds of things that threaten civilization. Okay, if you say it like that, and people make up all these things out of fears. Okay, so that's how the sea monster got there. Well, Perseus falls in love with her, and they tell him, you can marry her if you save her. And if he marries her, he can win the kingdom of her father. So Perseus swoops down and has a fight with the sea monster. That's shown in this art, which is actually modern art. You see him on top of the beast there. And so there's a battle, dramatic battle. They splash around. Perseus gets him in the neck with his sword. They're fighting on reefs. And Perseus wins. Some of the blood of Ceto gets on the seaweed and turns into coral. That's a little etiology, or a story explaining how something comes into being. The etiology explains the cause of something. So he rescues Andromeda, and he gets to marry Andromeda. This is actually a Roman wall painting from the 1st century AD of Perseus rescuing Andromeda. Another one by Rubens from the Renaissance. Rubenesque form there. And who's that above Perseus' head in the Renaissance painting? Cupid, exactly. And another one from the Renaissance that shows Pegasus. But there was a little problem. He's supposed to marry Andromeda now. In other words, he does a deed and wins the woman. More stages in the hero's career. But there's a little problem. She's already engaged to someone, Phineas. So what does he do? He stones him with Medusa's head. There's a little fight, and he whips out his secret weapon there. And he marries Andromeda. They had a son, Perseus, and the Greeks said that's where the Persians came from, which is not true at all, but that's the way the Greeks tried to explain the world around them. So there, he's won the wife and he's won the kingdom. But he's actually inherited the kingdom of his wife's father. So there's something interesting about sociology here. That who inherits the kingdom at this place? Joppa. Not the king's son or the king's daughter, but the king's son-in-law. And there are many myths about that. And there are so many myths that there's something to this. And why is that? Let's say something about that on the side, okay? There's a little more to Perseus after that. But you have many stories like this, and I think the reason is this, that if you just have a father and his son inheriting, then we know that this can decline. You don't know if your son is going to be the most worthy for the position. But if you have a daughter, well, then you can choose who is the most brave suitor. Who is the most brave one to inherit? You marry the daughter off, and that's the way you can have hereditary succession through the daughter, and you can actually choose who's the best man. So you can have a combination of both, an inheritance and real merit. And so this is a common story. And actually, that's the way Roman emperors chose the next emperor. They would choose someone, like a great general, and adopt them, to pretend it was hereditary, so they could have it both ways. Right. Other people say, well, he marries the daughter and gets her kingdom. This shows inheritance was through the daughter, but I don't think it is. The daughter doesn't really inherit. So I've made that up. Okay. And then Perseus goes back to his mother's island and saves his mother from this bad guy who's bullying her and had sent Perseus off to Medusa in the first place. He's really surprised Perseus shows up, but he doesn't have much time to think about it because Perseus stuns him with Medusa's head. And then his mother, Danae, gets to marry the good guy. And actually, this is kind of a second homecoming for Perseus, because you might think he might inherit this place too. But then he goes back to Argos, where his mother had come from. Is he going to inherit his grandfather's kingdom? He goes back up to Argos to see his grandfather, Acrisius. At first, he returns all these magical implements. The Gorgon's head, the shield, the pouch, and all that. Because heroes don't usually use magic. That was exceptional. And he goes up to Argos. But Acrisius is afraid of him because he had this oracle. If he has a grandson, he'll be killed by the grandson. So Acrisius flees, and Perseus chases him, and he throws a discus at one point, and it blows off course by accident and kills the grandfather by accident. But it's fate. That shows you cannot run away from your fate. It's the third time Acrisius tried to do that. And Perseus goes back to the region of Argos, and he does become king there. So that's the typical stage. You inherit the kingdom, although for him there's actually two such stories like that. And then he is the one who builds the palace at Mycenae. If you can picture the palace at Mycenae, the Great Bronze Age palace, supposedly Perseus built that. And then what happens? Then what happens to Cassiopeia and Andromeda? They all turn into constellations. That's their constellation prize. And what is that saying? Well, that's obviously from Ovid. Ovid is a Roman poet who wrote all these myths down. And he wrote a long epic called Metamorphoses. And this is a series of stories, and each one involves a transformation. So these kind of stories are sometimes just him being witty and having fun with it. But this seems to be saying that these are heroes from earlier times when people are close to the gods, and turning into stars is a way of saying you live on as a type of immortality, because they thought the stars and planets were immortal, and that's why our planets are named after the Greek gods. So there's actually a good movie about the Perseus story. Have you seen Clash of the Titans? It's a pretty good movie. You probably think it's a kid's movie, but it was a good movie from the 80s, and some early animation. Yes, Harry Hamlin and Burgess Meredith. And it's pretty well done. Of course, there are going to be differences from the story, from this story, but that's because every time you tell a story, it changes. And then Medusa also changes a little bit today. If you read poetry, and I'm sure you people do, right? Because young people don't read poetry, but I know you do. That in poetry, Medusa has become a feminist symbol. This feminist poetry about Medusa. How did Medusa become feminist? How did Pandora become feminist if she was the bringer of all evil? You know, in Madison is the Pandora store, right? Well, Pandora's the first woman, so that makes sense. And with Medusa, what happens is that they picked up on her and they said, well, it's men who turned her into a monster. This is what men do to women and make women into do that to women. And we're going to rescue her for our cause. So there's interesting poems about that. There's one, and that's just my caricature of how she, because it seems to be a paradoxical change, but it's an interesting poem by Mae Sarton about that and some other ones. Because there's one ancient story, there's a very late ancient story that Medusa was a beautiful woman who had been turned into this creature. And that kind of line picks up on that. But that's not actually the original myth of Medusa. That's somebody later, you know, making a transformation story. Since Medusa is this type of early monster at the edges of the earth, originally. It seems that the Gorgons may go back to Mesopotamian art possibly too. Actually, we can take a question or two there about Perseus and Medusa since we're going on to something else next. Anybody?
You said that Andromeda became a constellation. Who else became Andromeda?
Her mother, Cassiopeia. Okay, let's go to Hercules. Okay. Or in Greek, Heracles. This is the grandson of Perseus. So it's from this same dynasty in the region of Argos and Mycenae. Heracles in Greek is the same as Hercules. And we'll explain his name. Well, his mother was Alcmena, who actually, she was the grandson of granddaughter of Perseus. Sorry, so Hercules is going to be the great-grandson of Perseus. So Alcmena is two generations later. And she has a husband, Amphitryon. These are the parents of Heracles. These are two mortals. Well, they are from this area, but they go into exile and flee from there to Thebes, which is up north, north of Athens. This is a common thing with heroes, that you're expelled from your homeland, like Perseus and his mother were kicked out of Argos. Heracles' parents also leave there. With Jesus, they leave and go to Egypt at one point, if you want to compare that type of story. Okay, so they're up in Thebes. And Amphitryon is off fighting because his wife told him she won't have sex with him until he avenges the death of her brothers. So he has to fight these people, and Alcmena is waiting home. Well, who shows up? Alcmena, I'm home. It's me, Amphitryon. I did it. Let's have it now. And who is this? It's Zeus in disguise as Amphitryon. Right? Yes, he was not. So Zeus comes first, and he makes the night last three times longer, and is in bed with Alcmena. Well, just then, who shows up with the real Amphitryon? Hi, honey, I'm home. So that's what this shows. Actually, this is a scene from an ancient comedy. This would actually show Zeus coming to the window, because there you see Hermes. Okay, but so she became pregnant by both of them on the same night. And so this says a lot about Hercules. Hercules is the son of Zeus and Alcmena. He's a demigod. And he had a twin brother, Iphicles, who supposedly was the son of the mortal father, Amphitryon. That explains how she had twins. One's the son of Zeus, and so Hercules is a demigod. And so this is also a common type of story. So look at this. Hercules has two mortal parents. But his father is not Amphitryon, it's really Zeus. Where have we heard that before? Well, Mary is betrothed to Joseph and then marries him. But the father is not Joseph, it's really God. Right? It's a miracle. A ghost impregnated her that was God, right? And this is a common type of story, that the hero has a divine parent. So Alexander the Great claimed this, that his father was not Philip, who was an historical person in the 300s B.C., but Zeus came to his mother. His mother spread that story later, after he became great. And this goes back to the Egyptian pharaohs, many centuries before this, that they said that the god Amun came to the queen as her husband. In other words, the pharaoh mated with his wife, but it was Amun inside the pharaoh, coming as the pharaoh, and that explained how the next pharaoh was really the son of a god. So it's a divine kingship idea. And this also comes up with Theseus, the hero of Athens that we'll have later today. So heroes have to be demigods. Okay, so Heracles has a twin brother, Iphicles. You don't see him very much. And Iphicles has a son, Aeolus, who is the nephew of our hero. And Aeolus sometimes comes up as Hercules' helper, since heroes have bosom buddies often. Every hero doesn't have to have every element of the pattern, but that's one of the things. Now, Heracles was supposed to be the heir to the kingdom of Mycenae, where his parents came from. His mother's descended from Perseus. But this gets wrecked, because Hera is jealous that Zeus had this affair with Alcmena and has a son on earth. And this is usually Hera's role. Hera is the goddess of marriage, but she has a bad marriage, and what you see her doing is mostly persecuting Zeus's lovers and children on earth. So Hera tricks Zeus into getting somebody else to be born earlier and to become the king before Heracles can. So she asks Zeus, do you promise that the next descendant of yours who is born will be the ruler of Mycenae? Heracles is in line to be born next, but he's not born before he's born. And Zeus says yes, but it's a trick because Hera also has a daughter who's the goddess of childbirth, Eileithyia. So she gets her to delay the birth of Heracles, and she rushes at the birth of Eurystheus, who is Heracles' uncle. And Eurystheus is born first after 7 months, and it's a surprise to Zeus, and by what Zeus swore, Eurystheus is going to become the next ruler of Mycenae. And that's the way Hera gets at Heracles. And Zeus was so mad that he was tricked that he took the goddess blindness, with a capital B, blindness personified, he took her by the hair and hurled her in a rage from Olympus to men. So henceforth blindness would be among people and not among the gods. And that's a typical Greek view of people. That's it found in the Iliad, that story. Okay, so that's one reason that Heracles has to serve Eurystheus, who is the one who appoints his labors for him. And notice that this is also the expulsion from the kingdom, if that's a common stage in what happens to heroes. He's expelled from the dynasty of Mycenae. And so he may have to do great deeds to prove himself and maybe try to get it back as like Perseus. Well, the name Heracles means the glory of Hera. And that's maybe because Hera put him in this position to force him to do all these labors to win glory. So Heracles grows up in Thebes, up to the north, outside of his true kingdom of his father. And he has some youthful deeds. The first one is that Hera is nursing him. But he bites her nipple. They have this love-hate relationship. And the milk gushes forth and creates the Milky Way. Because the word for milk is gala. And that's G-A-L-A. That's still the word in Greek today, gala. And that's the word galaxy. It means milky, right? So that's an etiology of where the Milky Way came from. Now, by the way, that's a story. The Greeks knew that was a cute story. The Greeks did not think the Milky Way was Hera's milk, right? In other words, that's not the real science. That's not a case of myth. We might say, oh, this myth shows they didn't understand science. But they knew a lot more about the universe, and they knew that was a silly story. Okay. That purports to give an etiology. And then, so that's part of his love-hate relationship with Hera, which is why his name is kind of funny, what Hera Kleos means, glory of Hera. And then his first deed is in the crib. Hera sends these snakes to strangle him, and his parents are afraid, but baby Heracles reared up his head and lifted his little head and made his first trial of battle, says a Greek poet. And he strangled the snakes. And so there's a cartoon of it. And there's my baby boy trying to look like Heracles. Then he had an education. You have a military type of education, learning wrestling, archery, fighting, riding chariots. And also some liberal arts. He had a music teacher named Linus who taught him the lyre. But Heracles didn't go for this that much. He said, oh, why do I need to study classics? And he smashed the lyre over Linus's head and killed him. No liberal arts for him. So You see the music teacher with the lyre there. It's a lyre made out of a tortoise shell for the box. So actually, we think of Heracles as this brute strength. And if you make a movie today or a cartoon, we would have Arnold Schwarzenegger and some kind of cartoon strongman, right? But the Greeks are not as simple-minded as Hollywood and American. That Heracles actually does use his mind, and he is both a strong body and a clever mind. That is, it didn't show up in that story, but in the labors that come up, you see him using his mind and having to figure out things. Because the Greeks thought you need both. A sound mind and a sound body. That's the ideal of liberal arts that we get from the Greeks and from the Romans who picked that up from the Greeks. So that even comes out in some of the Hercules stories. Okay, so first a couple of more useful things. Then when he grows up, he hunts some lions for a local king. And as a reward, he gets the king's daughter, but not just one daughter, all 50 daughters he impregnates in one night. And then he marries his first wife named Megara, and they have 3 children. But Hera drove him mad, and he killed his wife and 3 children. And there's a tragedy about that by Euripides called Hercules Gone Mad. That's one reason he has to perform the labors. He has to serve Eurystheus, who's his uncle, who's the king of Mycenae, that kind of took it from what he was supposed to get. He has to serve Eurystheus to atone for these murders. And Eurystheus sets these trials for Hercules, which are the famous 12 labors. So let's say something about those. Really, Hercules has more than 12 labors. We've already mentioned several. He had many more. And these would actually grow over time. He kept getting more labors in Greek literature because he had to do everything. The number 12 was a round number. At one point, they built a temple of Zeus. Actually, the famous temple of Zeus at Olympia. Do you remember there was a golden ivory statue we saw of one of the famous images of Zeus seated there? Well, at that temple had 12 squares with scenes sculpted around the outside. And I'll show you one. And there were 12 of these, and they showed labors of Hercules because he was the son of Zeus. Well, that's where we get the list of the 12, the idea of 12 labors. There are actually many, many, many more. And Hercules is an older type of hero. These deeds, we'll go through a few of the main deeds of the 12, not all of them. But in general, he is a hero who has a club, and he doesn't have bronze armor. He's an earlier type of hero. He fights beasts. He fights these beasts on Earth. He's like cosmos versus chaos on Earth, as we said Zeus had done in the universe. So it's like an earlier type of hero. That is, he doesn't really put on armor and fight other heroes. It's not like cities fighting other cities, but a hero fighting threats on Earth. And this type of hero is called a monster slayer. Heroes fight lions, wild boars, and so on. And this goes back to Gilgamesh. This is actually Mesopotamian art of Gilgamesh, our hero from the Epic of Gilgamesh, which goes back to Sumerian 2500 BC, maybe. Okay, a few of these labors. So again, Eurystheus, the king of Mycenae, tells Hercules what to do, and he proves his greatness by going through and completing all these and trying to get some reward at the end. We don't know if he's going to become immortal. He is the son of Zeus, but remember how Gilgamesh had this dilemma too. So we'll see what happens to him at the end. First, he has to overcome these, which are like overcoming death experiences, and proving his greatness. Okay, so the first one is there's a lion ravaging the countryside called the Nemean lion from the place Nemea. And these, by the way, they start out close to Mycenae and then they go further and further out. So this lion's skin cannot be penetrated by any weapons. What is Hercules going to do? Well, he wrestles a lion and snaps its neck because he is brute strength. But he starts to figure out what to do. He starts to use his mind. So he skins the lion with its own claws. It could not be pierced by any weapons. Right? So he finds a loophole. And here he is wrestling the Nemean lion, or the lion of Nemea. And sometimes his nephew Eleus is shown accompanying him. And Greek heroes are always naked, by the way. This is why sometimes you see statues of Roman emperors who are naked. Roman emperors weren't supposed to be naked, but that's them trying to look like Greek heroes when you see that art. Because usually they show off with a military decoration, right? That's more Roman. Okay, so this is where he got the lion skin. And then he wore the lion skin. And that's what characterizes Heracles. You can always see the lion headdress and the lion skin hanging down. You can see the paws hanging down. And you can't see it too well here, but there's a lion skin draped here. And then he has a wooden club, because he's kind of in this early time before, you know, bronze suits of armor. He does have swords sometimes, and especially a bow and arrow. Now here, this is actually a head of Alexander the Great from a coin. Alexander tried to imitate Hercules. Alexander's a real person. Hercules, we don't know. Depends how you take the story. But Alexander wanted to mythologize himself. He wanted to mythify himself and be great and become a demigod. So he showed himself as Hercules and he adopted this headdress. Alexander, so 300s BC. Hercules, if he lived, would be 1200 something BC. Okay. Oh, let's say a couple more, then we'll take a break, okay? Then he has to perform this deed and bring it back to Mycenae to show King Eurystheus that he did it. However, Eurystheus is always afraid of him, so he runs away, and he has his henchmen meet Hercules. And this is kind of a joke. The henchman is called Copreus, which means something like shitty. Okay, so the second one is there's a hydra, this 50-headed dragon in a swamp nearby at Lerna, which is, by the way, an archaeological site with lots of prehistoric buildings here. And Hercules has to go kill it and cut off all its heads. He goes with his nephew, Eolus. Every time Hercules cuts off a head, what happens? Two grow back in the same spot. So they have to figure out what to do, and again, he has to use his mind. So the nephew goes and gets a torch, and every time Hercules beheads one head, they burn the stump so it can't grow back. So they knock off 49 heads, and the middle head is immortal, so they have to bury it under a boulder. And there's also a crab there in the swamp, and they smashed the crab. And one story is that became the constellation Cancer, meaning crab. So here, there they are with the 50-headed hydra. And that's a cartoon. The Disney Hercules movie actually has a beast like that near the beginning that he fights. Okay, well, when he killed the hydra, he took poison from the hydra's bile. He took its poisonous bile and put it on his arrows to get poison arrows. This is another case of good news and bad news. That sounds good, but we know that your triumph may prove to be your tragedy, right? And that eventually comes around to get him and is involved in his death a lot later. So that's ironic, but that's typically a Greek mixture of good and bad, because that's life. Okay, I'll just flip through a couple more. I won't say all these. He has to get these deer of Artemis, which are special deer. He captures them and he brings them back into the wild because he doesn't want to offend the gods. And so he's not always hubristic and arrogant because he actually returns these deer. Some people think he is hubristic and I don't, so that's why I said that. Then another one is he has to get a wild boar ravaging the countryside. at Mount Erymanthus in the northwestern Peloponnese. Well, 10 years ago, I took a group of adults on a tour of Greece, and we stayed here overnight, and you can see Mount Erymanthus out the window. And what did they serve us for dinner at this resort hotel? Boar. And they weren't trying to be funny either, I don't think. They weren't thinking about Hercules either. So this shows him with the boar that he threw over his shoulder and had to carry all the way back. It's a long way. And there's Athena mocking him as a hero. And there you see the lion skin. And here he has to show the boar back at Mycenae with his henchman Copreus hides in a big jar because they're afraid of Hercules. And that's a pithos jar. That was the type of jar Pandora brought the evils in. Right? He has to clean out the Augean stables, which are stables full of cattle dung. And now strength is not enough for this. He has to figure out how to do it, because it's kind of gross even for him. So he diverts two rivers. There are two rivers in the area, but he diverts one river through these stables and flushes them out. So he has to be smart and strong. The mind and body. He has to kill these deadly birds, the Stymphalian birds. He has to get a bull from Crete and bring it back. So now he's going overseas and he's going further and further away. He has to go up north to Thrace, which is in the North Aegean, the land between Greece and Turkey, north of the Aegean Sea. And he has to get these man-eating horses of the king up there, because this is kind of a barbaric area that's not fully Greek, and the king is a son of Ares, which to the Greeks is kind of not positive, that's kind of barbaric. And Hercules went with his boyfriend, Abderus. Now here's another way he's very Greek. In a couple of stories he has boyfriends, because this kind of older man, young man relationship came into Greek civilization at one time. And so he goes up there and he captures his horses and he gives them to his friend Abderus to hold. But that's a mistake. He wasn't thinking too much there. The horses eat Abderus. And they found a city after him, Abdera. So the people of Abdera, they were very proud of this. It was a real Greek city. And they said, we were founded in honor of by Hercules in honor of his friend. By the way, the most famous resident of Abdera in Greek history was Democritus, who's the person who invented the idea of atoms, that everything is made up of atoms, about 450 some or earlier BC, the atomic theory. Maybe we should take a break. It's been an hour. Is it a good time to take a break? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, then a little more of Heracles and then Theseus, okay? Thanks. Okay. Okay, so we're back with more of the labors of Hercules, and we're saying he doesn't know if he's going to be mortal or live on. Some heroes get that, but not them all. The Greeks couldn't assume that. Okay, so we have a few more labors and then his death story. Well, this is actually labor number 9, if anybody's counting. He has to go over to Asia. He's going further and further away geographically to get the girdle of Hippolyta, the queen of the Amazons. And the Amazons are these warrior women who are women only. They have excluded the men and killed the men off. And very unusual to have a tribe of warrior women. Well, Hercules shows up. He has to fight them. But the queen willingly offers him her girdle. What is that an image of? That's clearly an image of her sexually offering herself to Hercules. And then the other Amazons don't like this, and Hera rouses them up to fight. So he has a little war with the Amazons called an Amazonomachy, which is a popular subject in Greek art. Okay, we can say a little more about the Amazons. So here's Heracles fighting the Amazons. You can see it's Heracles with the lion skin and the club. With the Amazons, they are dressed as Persians. They are actually in Eastern garb. This is a way of saying they're barbarian. Barbarian means non-Greek. That they're a threat to the Greeks. They're Eastern and exotic and like the other that people talk about. Okay, so a lot of people want to know, were the Amazons real? Was it really a tribe of Amazons? Well, this is a story. The story is not going to tell us anything about that, because stories can be made up. Well, the Greeks thought the Amazons were real because they come up in Greek literature a number of times. In the Iliad, Priam is the king of Troy, and Priam says, oh, I wish I could fight like I did when I was young, when the Amazons came, women fighting like men, and we fought them. They were located in Asia somewhere, which means Asia Minor, the peninsula of Turkey. Asia originally was, by the way, was a little meadow over there. It was a Greek word for part of the coast of Turkey. And then Greek historians placed them in different places around that area. Well, and sometimes archaeologists go and claim they have found evidence for Amazons. There was an article in the Times a few years ago, February 97, entitled "Ancient Graves of Armed Women Hint at Amazons." So that was interesting. They found these graves that looked like nomads, which were women's graves, female bones with weapons in them. So what is that? So possibly there was something, but we don't know. Because can people make up these myths? Can the Amazons be made up out of Greek fears? That's another way to see these stories. Well, in Greece, women usually stayed home and kept the house. They weave, and they do important things, like take care of children and religious rites. But the women were inside, and the men were outside in war and politics. Well, what was the fear of the Greeks? That women would take over, right? And so you can see these Amazon stories as a fear. What happens when women take over? It's the castrating female type of psychological fear that they will kill all the men if you let the women out and run around on their own. They'll kill the men because the stories are that the Amazons, you know, they got pregnant, but they killed the men or kicked them out. And if they had male babies, what did they do? Same thing. So this could be made up as what's called inversion of society. That it could be the Greek hero has to go put them down because they're a bad model of the way women are supposed to behave. So if you put down these independent women, it reinforces the fact that women aren't supposed to fight men like that, you see. So that would be called inversion, that the myth might be social, but not a direct mirror of society, but an inversion, the fear, the threat to society that you have to put down. That's one way to see it, because it would be impossible to ever prove that they're real. Why is the Amazon River called the Amazon River? Well, in South America, well, this explorer from 16th century Spain said that he found a tribe of fighting women there, and that's why he named it the Amazon River. Okay, well, the other thing with the Amazons, everybody hears, is you always hear they cut off one breast so they could shoot their bow and arrow better. Well, the funny thing is the art does not show them with one breast, but with two breasts. And this, so that's just one story that was not the typical way they were portrayed all the time. This story seems to come from their name, because the word for breast is mazos, and the A is not. So their name looks like it means not breast. And that maybe gave rise to a story. Okay, what does this may mean? Why does it look like that? Well, they cut off one breast. The name could be a fake, the story could be a fake way to explain the name. Because maybe it's just a proper name. Every name doesn't have to mean something. So it could be a false etymology. You get that, like trying to explain Aphrodite's name, that she's born from the sea. Aphros means sea. That story may have arisen to try to explain her name. Okay. So with myths, with all these myths, it's more interesting what messages they're conveying than why it's important to the people telling them than whether they're historically true or not, which would just be a fact and would not convey all these literary and existential themes. Okay, then Hercules goes on. Does anybody have any question about the Amazons now, since there were a number of topics to discuss there? We can say if anybody wants to have another thought.
They
would get men. They would use men to get pregnant. Yes. And they'd kill them or they'd get rid of them. And the same thing if they had a male baby.
Like a spider. Amazons.
Yeah, right. And the funny thing is, today people glory in the Amazons, and they want to find this archaeology to prove that they were real, because you have lots of students writing papers and saying, I love the Amazons, go Amazons, powerful women. Well, what are we teaching people today? They killed the men. You know, this is gender wars. If we don't like men fighting those kind of wars, why do we want to say, okay, if we want to be powerful, we should do that? You know, it seems... there's been a lot of interest because of that. Okay. So more of Hercules' labors. He has to go get cattle from this character, Geryon, who lives in the far west. And now he's going beyond the known world. He has to go to an island in the far west, which is called Red Island. And this refers to the setting of the sun. And this is a kind of other world beyond our world, where you go to the end of our world. An atlas is there. And then you go across the waters to some island. So his last three get more and more into the other world. And they also said it at this point on this trip, he set up the Pillars of Hercules, which is another way the sky was held up. The Pillars of Hercules are at the Straits of Gibraltar. So that's an alternative. Instead of saying Atlas is holding up the sky, they said Hercules set up pillars there which are holding up the sky. The Pillars of Hercules is a Greek term for the Straits of Gibraltar. So we won't say that whole story, but the same kind of idea. He has to go to the far west where there are these nymphs, the Hesperides. Hesperia means west, and these are nymphs of the west. They live past Atlas, and they are divine nymphs. There's a magical golden tree, which was Zeus's wedding gift to Hera, and it has golden apples, and he has to get these golden apples of the Hesperides. And there's this tree guarded by a snake. So Hercules has to go to the far west and he passes Atlas. And there's a cute story here. First this shows these nymphs in their garden with the golden tree. And he comes up to Atlas, who's holding up the sky. And Atlas says, well, that's really far away. And you don't know the way, and I do. And they're nymphs, and I'm a titan. Atlas is. And Atlas says, I'll go get it for you. Why don't you just stand here and hold up the sky for me until I come back? So in this story, Atlas goes off and gets the apples from the Hesperides and comes back and shows Hercules, look, I got the apples. Now I'll just take them to Mycenae and I'll show them to Eurystheus. You just stay there holding up the sky. And now Hercules is not that dumb. Remember, he has to use his mind. So Heracles, he says, okay, that's fine. You go take them back. But can you just put a pillow up here to adjust this so I'm more comfortable? And Atlas goes to do that, and Hercules grabs the apples and runs away. So he was really pretty smart in a lot of his deeds. And this is a scene of Hercules actually is the one holding up the sky. And that's Atlas on the right with the apples, and Athena on the left showing that he's a hero. And this is one of these panels from the Temple at Olympia, where there are 12 of these, which give us the list of the canonical 12. And that's called a metope, that particular panel around the Greek temple. Then his last of the 12 is that he has to go get Cerberus, the three-headed hellhound, the dog guarding Hades. He has to go get permission from Hades to borrow Cerberus, bring him up to Earth. So Hercules chains him and drags him out, and here he's saying, you know, nice pooch. And he has to be strong to do this, and he has to be brave, and this is him overcoming death in a way, to go to Hades and come back up. And he doesn't disrupt the natural order, though, because he returns Cerberus. And this is something heroes often do. They go to Hades and come back. Gilgamesh had set the pattern. Gilgamesh had to go to Dilmun, which was an island of the gods where the only survivor of the flood lived, and come back. And Odysseus later on has to go to Hades and come back. And that's a common thing to prove you're a hero, because they're trying to push the limits of humanity. Can they become gods or do godlike things? This is modern art of Hercules and Cerberus. And some scholars have studied the name Cerberus. What is the etymology of the name Cerberus? Did I tell you this? Well, oh, that's a good guess. But it goes back to Indo-European linguistics, if you study the origin of these words. And somebody said, The name means spot. And I don't know how true linguistics is, but somebody else did that. And here he is showing Eurystheus, who's scared as though he's hiding in his pot, or maybe it's Eurystheus' henchman. Okay, well, Hercules had many more than 12 labors. There are lots of other ones that we won't say. At one point, he freed Prometheus. He was the one who freed Prometheus. He was actually descended from Prometheus, I think 14 generations down, and Zeus allowed that, and Hercules killed the eagle and freed him. He also sacked Troy at one point, and at one point, he had to serve a queen in Lydia, which is in Turkey, and Hercules is involved cross-dressing as a woman in this story, and at that point he has a girlfriend, and this is near the end of his life. He has this girlfriend when he has to do something in Asia for a year. But he has a wife at this point named Deianira. And by the way, how did he meet Deianira? Well, when he was down in Hades, he saw a dead hero, Meleager, who happens to be a famous hero. If you read the Iliad, there's a long scene about him. And Meleager says, "Hey, Hades, if you get back to Earth, you should meet my sister." So a very unusual way to be set up. And he marries Deianira. Okay, so now it's near the end of his life and the death story. And it goes like this, a little background. Hercules had defeated the Hydra. That was labor number 2 out of the list of 12. And he took the bile to use for poison on his arrows. The poison from the Hydra. And then at one point, when he's running around with these labors, he would have all kinds of side deeds going on. And at one point earlier, he had gotten into a fight with the centaurs. And here's a picture of a centaur. What is a centaur? Half man, half horse. This is a photograph of one of the last surviving centaurs in front of the Parthenon. Right? And, you know, they're found in Harry Potter, too, by the way, right? Yeah. So he got into a fight with these centaurs on the way back from the boar story. And they got drunk, and centaurs were always doing that. And they fought, and Hercules wounded Chiron, who's the most famous centaur. He wounded him with his poisoned arrow. Well, when Chiron was dying, he told his centaur friends, "Take my blood, because there's poison here, and you can use it later." Okay, so this is going to be the revenge of the centaurs. So then it's years later, at the end of Hercules' life, he's married to Deianira. And one day, a centaur named Nessus, since there were centaurs all around Greece until recently, Nessus was ferrying Deianira across a river, and he tried to rape her. Well, Hercules saw this, and he shot Nessus with an arrow. And it wasn't Chiron who said, "Collect my blood." That happens here. The centaurs were angry at Hercules because he had killed Chiron. But it's at this point that Nessus says to Deianira, Nessus is dying, and he says, "Collect my blood, because you can use this for a love potion. If Hercules ever strays for you, this will be an aphrodisiac, and you can collect this and use it." So he's tricking Hercules. He knows the poison of the Hydra's bile is in there from the poison arrow. So here is a famous vase of Hercules killing Nessus, which is in the Met in New York. And here's a Roman wall painting of that. So, Deianira is jealous of Heracles because he has a girlfriend. And she thinks this is a love potion, so she dips a cloak in this and sends it to him. And Hercules is burning up from the poison. His wife brought this about. There are actually many stories of this kind of thing. Although this way of telling the story, this version, says that she did it unwittingly and it was the revenge of the centaurs. And she is their agent. But Hercules is burning up and he's going to die. So he goes on a mountain and says, who will light my funeral pyre? And nobody will do it except one hero, Philoctetes. He lights the pyre. Hercules gives him the bow. So he has the bow of Heracles, which later comes into the Trojan War. Philoctetes goes on that. And Hercules is just a generation or two before that. So he's on the pyre, but Zeus brings Heracles up to Mount Olympus. Zeus gives him an apotheosis, meaning he becomes a god. And he becomes an immortal, and he marries Hebe, which means youth. And so, as a reward for his labors, he overcomes death, and he achieves immortality. But the Greeks didn't expect that you could achieve this. It had to be a special dispensation for Zeus that might happen to some early heroes, but nobody else. So this was very exceptional. Even all heroes did not get this. Normally the hero, like Gilgamesh, learned that they were mortal, since there's a hero is a demigod, and that's between gods and mortals in the first place. And the great thing about these hero stories is that they say a lot about people. It's not just about what Hercules did in 1200 whatever BC. It's not about some historical fact, but it's the heroes are typical people trying to achieve great things while they're alive and see how far they can go. It tells us about humanity and the human condition and our striving for more. Sometimes the more will mean that they'll have great fame that will live on, and occasionally, like with Hercules, he actually lives on, and people want both of those. That's very human also. And so was he a real person? Well, the Greeks thought he was a real person because in real historical Greece, the kings of Sparta were descended from Hercules. They said the sons of Heracles founded that area, the Heraclids, the sons of Hercules, and they traced their descent and they counted how many generations, and you had this in different places in Greece. So let's switch to these slides here. Okay, let's talk now about another hero, and this moves to another area, Athens. You know that ancient Greece was never one unity. There was no one Greece. That actually didn't happen until the 19th century, with nationalism and nation states that only came in the 19th century. So we were over here in the area of Argos, Mycenae, and Tiryns. And now Athens is a different place. And they have a hero, Theseus. So by the way, Heracles is a hero of this area, the Peloponnese, because they thought the sons of Hercules settled this whole area. About 1000 BC, they had stories of all that. Of them coming into this whole area of southern Greece. The Dorians, if you've heard of the Dorians or Doric columns, the Dorians thought they were descended from Hercules. So they especially worshipped Heracles in these Dorian areas. Well, Athens is a different area, and they have different dynasties, and they also are ethnically different. They are Ionian, as in the word Ionic, for a different type of column. And Theseus is the hero of Athens. But as it turns out, Theseus was developed later, that the Athenians were at one point fighting this area. Sparta was the main Doric city, or Dorian city, and the Athenians said, they have Heracles. Well, what about us? Okay, we have Theseus. And at one point they developed all these stories about Theseus to imitate Heracles for them to promote their Ionian ancestor. So some of the stories of Theseus are clear copies. Besides the fact that it'll have the typical hero pattern already, which may be an older background of why stories of Theseus will be like Heracles and like Perseus. Okay, so a different area, Athens. And first, actually, we have to start on Crete. Okay? Because Theseus is most famous for killing the Minotaur in the labyrinth. So let's go there first. Where did the Minotaur come from? And then go to Theseus and where he came from and how he did that deed. Okay? Oh, yeah, we can get that in. Okay. So this is on Crete now. Where, of course, it starts with Zeus falling in love with a woman. There was a princess in Phoenicia. Now, Phoenicia is non-Greek. That's the area of Lebanon. They were Semitic. They are related to the Hebrews. There was a woman, Europa, there. The princess. Zeus fell in love with Europa. He came to her as a bull, and he's mingling with the herd. And Europa thought this bull was cute. So it kneels down, she gets on his back somehow, and then it's all over, and this is Zeus as a bull, and he plunges into the sea and swims off from Phoenicia to Crete. So this is Zeus carrying Europa through the waters. See the fish? And in the slide, this woman with the wreath is Amphitrite, the wife of Poseidon. That's how she's shown. And they come to Crete. So this is where the word Europe comes from. So funny enough, Europe is named from a woman who is not European, but Near Eastern and actually Semitic. An Asian, right? And this is a nod, this story is the Greeks' nod to the fact that they knew they borrowed features from these older civilizations over there. Because what else did the Greeks get from Phoenicia, by the way? Well, when the princess Europa was missing, her brother Cadmus went looking for her. Cadmus couldn't find her, but he settled in Thebes and founded the city of Thebes in Greece. We said Hercules grew up there. And he brought the alphabet with him. The alphabet came from Phoenicia to Greece. The Greeks changed it a little bit from the Semitic characters into Greek. They added, for example, they added vowel signs that, you know, Hebrew and Semitic didn't have. But that was the story of how the alphabet came from Phoenicia to Greece. It really did come from there. So this kind of story shows Near Eastern influence, multiculturalism. And Cadmus, by the way, his daughter Semele was the mother of Dionysus, right, who came from Thebes, too. That was Cadmus again. Okay, so that was the brother of Europa that was looking for her. And Europa now is on Crete with Zeus. So Zeus and Europa mate on Crete, and they have a son, Minos, and a couple of other sons. But Minos becomes the king of Crete. Now he's also a demigod. And at one point he asks Poseidon for a sign. He says, if you send me a bull from the sea, I will sacrifice the bull. The bull comes up, but Minos neglects to sacrifice. Do not anger the gods. This would be hubristic. And as punishment, Poseidon gets the wife of Minos to fall in love with this bull from the sea. And the bull makes... So Pasiphae is the wife. She falls in love with this bull. Well, how does she mate with the bull? The artist Daedalus is the greatest artist ever, and he is living in Crete at the court of Minos. He builds a wooden cow, and it's so realistic that the bull mates with it. And inside this cow, Pasiphae is hiding because she has these bestial urges. So the bull from the sea and Pasiphae are the mothers of the Minotaur. She gives birth to the Minotaur, which is a man with a bull's head. There's a lot of bull on Crete. If you go there, you you see it in their religion, in the Bronze Age, to bull artifacts. Okay, so that's where the Minotaur came from. And, oh, by the way, have you ever read Mary Renault, The Bull from the Sea? You know, it's through historical novels, right? Yeah, a whole series of books. So this Minotaur is born, and Minos gets Daedalus to build a labyrinth to house the Minotaur. Daedalus is like the prototypical engineer and artist and craftsman. There are a number of things named after Daedalus today. Do you know James Joyce? He used Daedalus as the name for the artist. Okay, so the labyrinth is a prison for the Minotaur. And here's the Minotaur kicking back. And a silly picture of the Minotaur. Picasso loved the Minotaur. Actually, you see artists using this. The Minotaur becomes kind of, seems like some raw physicality that they were trying to bring in. So what happened was, King Minos was the king of Crete. His palace was at Knossos. And he had this labyrinth with the Minotaur trapped inside. Well, at one point, Minos was imperialistic, and he got involved with Athens, and he subdued Athens. And Athens had to send 7 boys and 7 girls every year to feed the Minotaur. This is where our hero comes in, Theseus, who is the hero of Athens. He, at one point, he says, Argo, send me, I'll kill the Minotaur and free Athens from the rule of Crete. Okay? So now let's go to Theseus, because there are more about him, where he came from. Okay, so Theseus is the hero of Athens, and we'll go back to where he came from, how he was born, and how he grows up to join back up to the point where he goes to Crete and kills the Minotaur. And that also has this little political element that he frees Athens. Okay, so Theseus is the hero of Athens. They promoted him at one point to rival Heracles, as we were saying. And he has 2 typical patterns in his life. Let's mention those patterns again. A miraculous birth. Labors to rise to manhood. Excluded from the kingdom. He goes on a quest or a journey. Does great deeds. He might be saved by a helper. Maybe Athena. Divine help. Maybe you get a woman, gain a wife, or marry a princess. Maybe you get her throne, or maybe you go back and get your father's throne that you've been excluded from. And do you become a god or not? Do you have a special death story? And we also said that heroes kind of civilize the earth by defeating these monsters that represent chaos. So Theseus was actually a little more advanced than Heracles that way. Heracles fought these wild beasts. Theseus is more associated with Athens and developing the city of Athens, and saving it from Crete is also a little more political. So he's a little more what's called a civilizing hero. Just another step in the progress of civilization. Okay, so here's Athens, and there are various stories of the founders of Athens. And then their first great hero, Theseus. We see Athens promoting him at a time they were fighting Sparta, who had Hercules already and older. Okay, so Theseus' father was the king of Athens, Aegeus. Aegeus could not have a son. So he goes to the oracle of Apollo at Delphi. And he gets a famous ambiguous oracle. Do not open the swelling mouth of the wineskin until you come to the height of the Athenians. Well, how does that help? You have to figure it out. Of course, if you're wrong, well, the oracle can't be wrong. It has to be always right. That's one reason help for them to be riddling and obscure. Well, the story goes like this, that Aegeus is traveling, and he comes to the city Troezene, which is across the water from Athens, which actually had ties with Athens, even though, it was in that Doric area of the Peloponnese. It's connected with Athens. He goes there, and he has sex with the king's daughter, Aethra. The father got him drunk, so he slept with the king's daughter, and she gets pregnant. And somehow this fulfills the oracle, which is a puzzle. Aegeus impregnates Aethra, and supposedly Poseidon came to her on the same night and also got her pregnant. So she is pregnant with Theseus, who has 2 fathers, Aegeus, the king of Athens, and also Poseidon. Just like the Hercules story, another way of saying the hero is a demigod. Well, Theseus grows up in Troezene. He grows up outside of Athens, and his father goes home. But Aegeus leaves these tokens. He puts a sword under a boulder and a couple of sandals. And he says, if anybody can lift this boulder and get this sword, I'll know that's really my son. Because only my son will be strong enough to lift this. So Theseus grows up. He lifts the rock and gets the sword. Now you've heard this before. You're thinking the sword and the stone. Well, it's probably partly borrowed from this. And that sword, of course, is divine. Only the true divine king will be able to pull it out. Theseus is the only one who can do it. And this says a couple of things about kings at that time. Theseus was the son of Aegeus, so he will inherit the throne. But you can't just have any son inherit the throne, because it might be a wimp or somebody crazy or a bad king. It might be, if you grew up in that, you just might want to spend your money all the time, right? So most people are suspicious of straight heredity. So then they say, well, you have to be the strongest one. Only the true king can lift the stone. That's saying you're really strong, you really have true merit, and you deserve to be king. And the Greeks thought both go together. This is a very aristocratic notion, that only the true heir will be the one who's really strong enough. That strength and heredity go together. That is the justification for heredity from these earlier aristocratic notions of earlier Greece. Okay. So Theseus takes this sword, and this art shows Athena with him. And he goes up the road from Troezene to Athens. There's the map. And on the road up the coast, he has six deeds, where he meets all these bad guys and robbers. And this is like him freeing the roads, making the roads safe for civilization. So notice it's a little more civilized, a little more political than what Hercules did, which were like these beasts at the edges of the world and all that. That he's actually going up to Athens and more related to a city, Athens. And so those are pleasant characters. One is a clubber who clubs everybody. Theseus gives him a dose of his own medicine and clubs him to death. One is called the Pine Bender. There was this character, Sinis, S-I-N-I-S, who would trick passers-by and say, here, help me bend this pine tree down. And then he thought it was a big joke, he would let it go and they would fly away. So Theseus does that to him. So he's a good guy versus the bad guy. This is civilization against barbarians. This is Greeks against monsters or Greeks against foreigners, right? And most of their art is this kind of allegory. Most of their myth. And then there's a giant sow he takes on. And then there's a character, the foot washer, Skyron. This is a plate that shows his various deeds. You can't see them that well. And these are some metopes from a temple that showed them, just like the other one that had the ones of Heracles at another temple. So there's a character, Skyron, who makes travelers wash his feet. And then he thinks it's a big joke. He kicks them off. They go over the cliff where a giant turtle eats them. Well, what does Theseus do? He gets Skyron to wash his feet, gives him a dose of his own medicine, and Skyron is eliminated, thrown off the cliff, eaten by the giant turtle. And then Procrustes is an interesting one, because we still have a word from Procrustes. Procrustes, right, do you know what he did? Procrustean comes from this. Procrustes had a bed, and he made travelers lie in his bed. If you were too small for the bed, he stretched you, and if you were too big, he cut you off to fit the bed. There are some stories he had two beds, but I don't think that's as good a story. So, of course, Theseus shows up and does that to Procrustes. Well, this is where we get the word a Procrustean solution. A forced solution to make something fit is Procrustean. That comes from this guy who forced you to fit into his bed. Do you know that word, Procrustean?
No?
Okay. Well, I found this in the news a few years ago, and I wrote this down because students haven't heard this word anymore. Not even on the SAT. And it said, this bill's approach to reducing the problem of asbestos litigation is to adopt the most Procrustean solution imaginable, depriving people of the right to sue. Or in science, you could say if somebody forces the data to fit, and making a product conclusion from the data, you say it's Procrustean. You hear that word in math and science sometimes, especially if they know something. So these words are getting lost more and more. just like the centaurs are dying out. Okay. And so Theseus kind of frees to makes the road safe. There are six of these. Another one is wrestling somebody. And he comes to Athens. He shows up in Athens. But they don't know it's him yet. And his father, Aegeus, is married to the wicked stepmother, Medea. Maybe you know Medea from other stories. This is actually at the end of Medea's life. She's a witch from Asia who's had a long career in other stories. We can't tell all the stories. But Jason had brought her to Greece in the Jason and the Argonauts story. And then he dumped her at one point, and she goes off to Athens, and she marries Aegeus. And so she wants her children to succeed to the throne of Athens. So that's the folk tale of the wicked stepmother, because she wants to get rid of Theseus to promote her own kids. And she gets Aegeus to send this stranger off to fight the bull of Marathon. It's a bull that is near Athens. Marathon is near Athens. And Theseus has to fight the bull. So now here's a few more labors that he has to do to prove himself before he can be the true heir and assume his rightful place in Athens. He fights this bull of Marathon, and supposedly this was the same bull that Hercules brought back from Crete in one of his labors. And that's because the Athenians are telling this story, and they say, well, the Dorians, like the Spartans, they say that Hercules was so great and he got this bull. Well, in Athens, we have Theseus and he got a bull. In fact, it was the same bull, he was just as great as Hercules. So they made up these stories to copy Hercules, for Athens to copy, or to rival Sparta, I mean. Okay? And so, then Medea tries to poison him, but Aegeus recognizes the sword, he knows it's his son, and it's a true heir. So Medea flees back to Asia, where she had come from. She was actually a witch. And it's now that Theseus gets involved with the Minotaur, because Athens has to send seven boys and seven girls every year to feed the Minotaur because they're subject to Crete. So Theseus says, let me go. I will kill the Minotaur and free Athens. So there's a little more political element there. And let's go back to that now. So he sails down to Crete. And he shows up. And how are you going to kill the Minotaur? Well, he has the help of a woman. The king's daughter falls in love with him, Ariadne. And she will help the stranger out of love and betray her father for her lover. This is also that comes up in some of the stories, that power can be so great. So Daedalus gives them a ball of thread. He's the craftsman who comes up with the idea. He gives Ariadne a ball of thread that she gives to Theseus. Use this to track your way into the labyrinth so you know how to get out. And we get a word for that, clue. In Old English, clue means a ball of thread. And from this kind of story, that's how it means what it means today. Okay. So Theseus goes in and kills the Minotaur. And here are some slides of that, the Minotaur, and now Theseus killing the Minotaur. And by the way, if you notice this, the Minotaur is depicted a little bit like the Amazons were, with Persian type of costumes to show it's a monster, the Greek against the barbarian, the civilization against the threat to civilization. So here, this arch shows Athena with him to mark him as a hero. And he kills the Minotaur and sails away with the king's daughter, Ariadne, the daughter of Minos. They elope, and he's sailing back to Athens with her. However, just being a hero did not mean he was perfect. He leaves her sleeping on Naxos, and he dumps her basically and leaves without her. But she got a better deal, because the god Dionysus showed up, swoops down while she's sleeping on Naxos, and marries Ariadne. So she married Dionysus. And that's always a party, right? And, of course, there's a famous opera about that, Ariadne auf Naxos. Theseus sails back to Athens. And this is also good and bad. Okay, it's good he killed the Minotaur, but when he sails back, there's a tragedy. It's Greek. Life has got to be tragic. And his father had told him, if you come back safely, change yourself from black to white so I know. Theseus forgets to change his sail, and he sails back with his black sail, and his father jumps off the cliff. His father is Aegeus, and what's named after him? The Aegean Sea. Theseus comes back and he becomes the king of Athens. And he became a political hero. They thought he unified Athens, that he was one of the founders of the state. He also got involved with the Amazons. The Athenians said, well, Hercules fought the Amazons, and our hero is Theseus. And he fought the Amazons too, so there are stories of him fighting the Amazons as well. And he actually had a son with the Amazon queen. And there are more stories like that about Theseus that we won't say. There's a few more things he did. Although he never became immortal like Hercules. But let's say this story briefly. What happened back home on Crete, right? Or back on Crete. Theseus killed the Minotaur and got away. He took the king's daughter Ariadne. Well, back on Crete, King Minos is very upset. How did they get away and do this? So he punishes Daedalus. Daedalus built the labyrinth, and he also gave them the thread to help Theseus get away. That Theseus used to get out of the labyrinth. So Minos locks Daedalus and his son up in the labyrinth. And this is Daedalus and Icarus, the famous story. So by the way, Daedalus is locked up in his own creation. He built the labyrinth and now it's his prison. So in the 20th century, Daedalus became a symbol for the artist, that the artist is trapped in his own creation, the suffering artist. Some 20th century people pick up on that image. Okay, Daedalus and Icarus are trapped in the labyrinth. How do they get out? Daedalus is the great builder. He builds wings out of wax and feathers to imitate birds. And they sail out the window. Daedalus had actually come from Athens originally. That's because the Athenians think they are so clever and that this clever craftsman had to come from Athens. And he wants to fly back there. And he warns Icarus, just do not fly too close to the sun or too close to the water. Either way will be bad luck. And this is a famous Greek moderation, avoid the extremes. So they're flying away, but Icarus is so happy, exulting in flying, and he flies too high, the sun melts his wax, and he plunges into the sea. And there's still a sea called the Icarian Sea, off the coast of Turkey, near an island called Icaria, which is near Samos, a bigger island. And it's just a little small place there in the sea where Icarus plunged into the sea. And this is a moral. This is a moral for children. You should listen to your dad. Right? And this is your classic Greek story of hubris. Hubris means going too far, exceeding your limits. Because if a human flies too close to the sun, the people belonging there, that's where the gods are. You are not a god. You go past the limits and you fall. That's hubris. You're punished for hubris, too much arrogance, for passing your limits. And that's this pattern of Greek tragedies. Somebody goes too far and they fall. Right? So that's a typical hubris story, which is about mortality, that people have limits, people should be moderate. For example, that's in stories like Midas and the Golden Touch. Everything turns to gold, but it's bad luck. This greed is excessive hubris because he's not human anymore. He can't even eat or touch his daughter. Everything he touches turns to gold. So these are negative stories and a moral of moderation. And this goes along with the democratic ideal of Athens, to be moderate, the middle way, so everybody's more or less equal, nobody piles up all the gold. Right? It's also a political message, as well as a mortal message about human existence. Okay, so here's just a slide, Daedalus and Icarus, wings to go. That's a chicken place in Philadelphia, okay? It reminded me of them. And Daedalus gets away, and then he goes to Sicily, and Minos comes looking for him, and Daedalus manages to trick him to engineer Minos' death and outsmart him. Okay, so Here's some art of Daedalus and Icarus, especially the famous painting by Bruegel, landscape with the fall of Icarus, where you see Icarus plunging into the sea. Where is Icarus? It's a Dutch old master painting. You see him? All you see are his legs. And there are two famous poems about this, which I think is a fascinating thing about mythology. Because Bruegel came and made this painting in the Northern Renaissance, and then in the 20th century, two poets made poems about that painting. All the levels of how much mythology is used. So I'll just say this for a second. There's a famous poem by William Carlos Williams called, in a book called Pictures from Bruegel. He wrote a poem, Landscape with the Fall of Icarus. Do you know William Carlos Williams? He was a doctor in New Jersey. And 10 years ago, I was giving a talk to adults, and someone said, he was the doctor who gave birth, who, what do you call it? Delivered my brother, right? So he says, according to Bruegel, when Icarus fell, it was spring. A farmer was plowing his field, etc. Significantly, off the coast, there was a splash, quite unnoticed. This was Icarus drowning, right? Kind of the banality of evil, this, right? How every day it is. And then W.H. Auden came and wrote another poem about that, about this painting, which I like. He says, about suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along, etc. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water. And the ship had somewhere else to go. You know, everyone's doing something else. And don't even notice Icarus plunging in that painting. Okay, so that's the story of the labyrinth, the Minotaur, Theseus, the hero of Athens, and hero patterns in general. And archaeologists went and found the palace at Knossos, where King Minos ruled. And they said, there's this very intricate palace there from the Bronze Age. And they said, maybe that's the basis for the labyrinth story. So that would be another story, how archaeology of Crete has bulls and complex palaces, and maybe all that gave rise to these myths. So thanks. Thanks for staying a couple minutes after, and next time we have one more. The last one is about the Trojan War, especially the Iliad and the Odyssey. And there I will say something about archaeology, of what we know about Troy, and was the war real? Questions today? Oh, excuse me. Yes?
You mentioned Delphi a number of times and the oracles. And when I went